I call Senate Resources Committee to order. Today is Friday, March 18th, 2016. The time is 3:33 p.m. We're meeting here in Juneau in the Capitol Building. Committee members present today, Vice Chair Senator Costello, Senator Stoltz, Senator Coghill, myself, Senator Giesel, and I expect Senator Machiki will be joining us shortly. Senator Stedman is excused today. I also am expecting Senator Wilikowski to join us. We've got a guest with us today. I have invited Representative Dave Tallarico. He is the co-chair of the House Resources Committee. We had an empty seat today. I thought he would enjoy being here. He represents the Interior Healy area, and so this is certainly a relevant topic for him. Thank you to Ann and Matt, who are helping us record the minutes today and with the audio. So, today the committee is going to hear from the Bureau of Land Management, otherwise known as BLM. The BLM is preparing a resource management plan for various holdings in Alaska. These plans encompass the activities of multiple user groups who use BLM land. So, I am very pleased and honored to welcome State Director Bud Cribley and Georgina Berenger to the table today to give us a presentation and answer questions from committee members. So welcome, Mr. Cribley and Ms. Berenger.
Welcome. And I want to thank you very much for the opportunity to come down and give you a presentation on our current planning efforts that we have, that the Bureau of Land Management has in Alaska right now, and just identify some of the issues that the public is identifying to us as far as concerns and items that they want us to address in these land use plans that we're developing. I've got Georgina is the planning lead for the Bering Straits Western Interior, or Bering Sea Western Interior Land Use Plan, and has been the principal person giving our presentations at our public meetings and such. She's very knowledgeable of this plan, and she's also been giving presentations to different user groups on our Central Yukon plan and an update on our Eastern Interior plan that we also have in play right now. And so I've asked her to come down, and knowing the details and all, she would be answering all the questions anyway. Asked her if she would come down and give her presentation to you all, and from there we can answer questions for you.
That sounds great. Ms. Berenger, as you present, is it all right with you if committee members interrupt with questions, or would you rather wait till the end?
Might work best if we could wait till the end.
Okay.
Sounds good. All right.
And so I'll let you begin. And if you would, just for the record, you know, we've got folks listening online as well as it's being televised, and our secretary is recording it. Identify yourself and your affiliation for the record.
Sure. Well, again, my name is Georgina Berenger, and I'm the Bering Sea Western Interior Resource Management Plan Project Manager. For those folks listening online, do they have access to the presentation?
The PowerPoint is online.
Right. Okay,
yes,
so what I'll do for the folks listening online is refer to the page or slide number that I'm on so you can follow along. Great. Okay. Well, again, as Bud said, thank you very much for the invitation to have us here today. We're happy to receive the request to share more information about our land use planning process and stakeholder involvement as you had requested. We'll also discuss decisions, how our decisions in these plans will affect residents that live in proximity to BLM land and other users of BLM land. Some specific user groups we were asked to cover include hunters, fishermen, hikers, mushers, developers, etc. Additionally, we were asked to explain the role of public comment, how it is incorporated into the plans, and future opportunities for stakeholders to engage. This presentation, as Bud indicated, is a compilation of 3 to 4 individual presentations. So as I go through it, you're going to notice some different formats. And I'm here to speak on behalf of those 3 to 4 other presenters. So as such, we'll all do our best to address your questions at the end. Slide number 2. Related to your request for our presentation, today we will cover the land use planning process overview, stakeholder involvement, the 3 ongoing resource management plans in the state, and we will take questions at the end. Slide number 3. The BLM mission is to sustain the health, diversity, and productivity of the public lands for the use and enjoyment of present and future generations. The 1976 Federal Land Policy Management Act requires the BLM to develop RMPs for public lands. The BLM refers to their land use plans as RMPs, and they're similar to the Fish and Wildlife Service's Comprehensive Conservation Plans, or CCPs, which you also might have heard of. The Park Service's GMPs, or General Management Plans, and what the Forest Service terms their forest plans. BLM RMPs are a preliminary step in the overall process of managing public lands and are designed to guide and control future management actions for up to 20 years with the intent of helping us achieve our mission of sustaining lands for present and future generations. The types of decisions we make in RMPs are desired future resource conditions, management actions that are needed to achieve those desired conditions, and allowable uses, which describe how and where to manage uses and activities on the land and where uses and activities should be excluded. Some key issues in all of BLM Alaska planning efforts include Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act withdrawals, ANILCA provisions, locatable and leasable minerals, travel management, subsistence use, fish and wildlife habitat management, wilderness characteristics, wild and scenic rivers, special management areas such as areas of critical environmental concern, withdrawals, and land status. Slide number 14, next slide. Or number 4, excuse me. Even though land use plans are comprehensive planning documents, there are some decisions or actions that land use plans do not address. So as the slide covers, land use plans do not lift existing withdrawals. However, they make one of three recommendations to the Secretary of Interior, whether to revoke, retain, or modify existing withdrawals. Land use plans do not affect land conveyances, change any hunting or fishing regulations, resolve RS-2477 rights of ways, designate 17B easements, increase or fund any law enforcement on the land, affect predator control, or make site-specific project decisions. So, for example, the Bering Sea Western Interior Land Use Plan will not make decisions related to the Donlin Mine. Central Yukon Land Use Plan will not make decisions related to Ambler Road, and Eastern Interior will not make decisions related to Victoria Creek, because all those projects are site-specific and require a different level of analysis. Next slide, slide number 5. Here's a diagram of the current BLM the current BLM planning process. It's a linear, complex process. The BLM will take public comment at any point in time during a land use planning process. There are currently 3 required stages where official comment periods are offered, as is shown on red on this slide here. And those official comment periods are offered to encourage comment by a deadline so that it may be analyzed and organized in a helpful way for BLM reference. These official public comment periods are circled in red, and the first one you see is scoping, and then at the draft RMP stage, and finally the final RMP 30-day window. Next slide. Slide number 6. BLM Alaska recently pilot tested a new public involvement step that is not required by the National Environmental Policy Act. The BLM might require this future step through proposed changes to our planning regulations that the BLM refers to as the Planning 2.0 effort. The proposed rule to change the BLM's planning regulations was just published February 25th in the Federal Register, with a 60-day comment period closing on April 25th. The BSWI RMP, Bering Sea Western Interior RMP, was the first to conduct preliminary alternative outreach nationwide last spring, 2015. The RMPs for Western Oregon held some public listening sessions following release of their planning criteria, but it did not involve preliminary alternatives. Eastern Colorado and Alaska's Central Yukon RMP will incorporate this step next. I recently shared our effort and lessons learned on a national call that included BLM planners nationwide. BLM Alaska felt it was an important step in getting stakeholder input on preliminary alternative concepts prior to creating a full range of alternatives for the draft RMP. This step also serves to break up the stretch of time between when we go to the public first for that scoping outreach period and then when we go to the public next for the draft, the release of the draft RMP, which helps us keep our stakeholders informed. Next slide. There we go. Slide number 7. This slide shows the 3 BLM land use planning efforts that are currently underway in Alaska, including Eastern Interior RMP with 6.5 million acres of BLM-managed public lands, Central Yukon with 13 million acres of BLM-managed land, and Bering Sea Western Interior with 13.4 million acres of BLM-managed lands. The RMP decisions made for each of these planning areas will only apply to the BLM-managed lands within the planning area. So those planning areas are pretty broad, but they do capture all the BLM land within there is where the decisions are going to apply. The reason why our planning areas are so broad is that we also try to be consistent and coordinate with the neighboring landowners as well. So Fish and Wildlife Service, the state, and the National Park Service. First, I will cover the Eastern Interior RMP. Next slide, slide number 8. The Eastern Interior planning process began in 2008. The draft of this plan already came out, and they are working on revisions to the draft. The proposed plan is anticipated in 2016. Within this planning area, there are 4 subunits. The White Mountains subunit, which contains the White Mountains National Recreation Area, Beaver Creek Wild and Scenic River, and then there's the Stees subunit, which contains the Stees NCA, National Conservation Area, and the Birch Creek Wild and Scenic River. There's also the Upper Black River subunit and the 40 Mile subunit. Currently, BLM is going through final BLM and cooperating agency document reviews on the proposed RMP and final EIS. The State of Alaska, Gwich'in Z. Gwich'in, and Village of Chalkeetsik are cooperating agencies and will have one more opportunity to look at the plan before it is published. Additionally, the Governor's Office will have a 60-day consistency review period prior to the Record of Decision. BLM plans to meet with the Gwich'in Z. Gwich'in and the Village of Chalkeetsik once more before publishing the proposed RMP final EIS. BLM held 2 subsistence hearings earlier on the draft EIS and supplement to the draft EIS during the planning process. Next slide. Slide number 9, Eastern Interior RMP. Historically, there have been few permitted guides in the planning area, and due to that, this RMP made no hunting guide permit allocation decisions. Over the past 5 years, however, user demographics have changed, as has the increased interest from guides and outfitters of all types. In the fall of 2015, this field office received numerous applications for commercial hunting guides. So the Eastern Interior Field Office now intends to begin a separate recreation-focused NEPA analysis in 2016 to determine special recreation permit allocation numbers in high-use areas during high-use periods. This will help to essentially address capacities for recreation opportunities, such as how many river trips should occur on Beaver Creek during high-use periods. This might include regular river trips or hunting river trips, or how many guided mushing tours should occur in the White Mountains during high-use periods. Further steps for stakeholder engagement are also outlined on the slide. Even after the Record of Decision is issued, the last 2 bullets on this slide indicate that the window is still open for public involvement. Next, I will cover the Central Yukon RMP. This RMP is located in Interior Alaska. The heavy red line on the map shows the planning area boundary. The yellow land represents 13 million acres of BLM-managed public land. RMP decisions, again, will only apply to the BLM land. The planning area includes the Dalton Highway, the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, and the designated utility corridor surrounding the highway and the pipeline. The designated utility corridor is shown as the reddish-pink line. There are many other land ownerships within and adjacent to the planning area, including, for the Park Service, Denali and Gates of the Arctic National Parks, shown in purple. Fish and Wildlife Service has 7 refuges, the Arctic Yukon Flats, Canute, Selawik, Koyukuk, Innoko, and Nowitna, which are all shown in green. State of Alaska Native Corporation lands, shown in blue and brown, and then military lands, Tanana Flats, Fort Greeley, Clear Air Force Base, and parts of Fort Wainwright and Eielson Air Force Base. Additionally, there are 24 remote communities in or near this planning area, 19 federally recognized tribes. The Central Yukon RMP has two formal cooperating agencies, the Fish and Wildlife Service and the State of Alaska. Currently, no tribes are formal cooperators. However, BLM is required to consult with tribes. At the beginning of all RMP efforts, the BLM notifies all tribes within the planning area about the process and holds meetings in many communities, continues to keep tribes informed with updates and newsletters, and the BLM remains available to call into tribal council meetings or visit communities for additional consultation. Next slide. Slide 11. This is a timeline and a status update for the Central Yukon RMP. Currently, they're developing preliminary alternatives. Once the preliminary alternative concepts are drafted, the Central Yukon Field Office will have a preliminary alternatives outreach period, likely this fall, similar to what I mentioned BISWE had last spring. They're going to hold public meetings in interested communities and government-to-government meetings with interested tribes. Preliminary alternatives will be available on the website and mailed out to communities. Next, we'll cover some of the issues identified during Central Yukon's 2013-14 scoping period. The following planning issues were identified during their scoping process. The utility corridor withdrawal or public land order 5150, which is along the Dalton Highway, access and travel management, invasive species particularly is an issue along the Dalton Highway for them. This is otherwise known as noxious plants or non-native invasive species. Minerals management and withdrawals, or old withdrawals from the early 1970s that are still in place, demand to remove, there's both demand to remove these and demand to keep these. Sand and gravel is an issue. There's a high demand for sand and gravel on the Dalton Highway. The gas line and Ambler Road would also increase demand for sand and gravel. Recreation and visitor services along the Dalton Highway, subsistence and management of wildlife habitat are also other examples of issues that were raised during scoping. Per your request for this presentation, I will talk about a couple of these issues in more detail. Next slide. The Central Yukon Field Office has 9 commercial hunting guides operating under SRPs. 5 of these guides operate in or near the Dalton Highway corridor, with sheep or brown bear hunting being their primary focus. Generally, SRP holders are small-scale operators taking less than 5 animals, frequently only 1 to 2, on BLM lands. The Dalton Highway Corridor Dall Sheep Guide SRP holders are operating under a programmatic EA, environmental analysis, that was completed in 2012. This programmatic EA sought to address 2 issues. First, the conflict between operators and improving hunt quality for guided conflicts, and second, perceived conflicts between subsistence users and guides in the vicinity of Wiseman. The BLM sought to mitigate these issues by 1, permitting guide operations in discrete areas, and 2, only authorizing sheep guiding on BLM lands east of the Dalton Highway as a means of distancing guided hunting activities from subsistence hunting. In partnering with commercial hunting guides who operate on BLM-managed lands, the BLM monitors public land user experience, impacts to subsistence, the wildlife resource, and wants to ensure that these authorized activities will not result in undue and unnecessary degradation of resources on public lands. We will continue to cooperate with the State of Alaska in development of this RMP. Next slide. Slide number 14, the utility corridor withdrawal. This topic is one of the bigger issues for the Central Yukon RMP. The utility corridor withdrawal, or Public Land Order 5150. These lands were withdrawn as a utility corridor. The withdrawal prohibits conveyance of these lands to the State of Alaska. The State of Alaska has top-filed the lands within the corridor and wants BLM to modify PLO 5150 to allow conveyance of the lands in the corridor to the state. In order to convey lands to the state, this withdrawal would need to be modified so the state top files can attach. Then if the state prioritizes their top filings, the BLM would convey to the state. If this were to occur, it would reduce federal public lands available for subsistence hunting and substantially reduce BLM presence along the Dalton Highway. BLM will be looking for additional input from stakeholders regarding this issue. We will consider an alternative in the draft RMP that allows for conveyance of these lands to the state. Next, I will present information related to the Bering Sea Western Interior RMP. This is the vision statement that the RMP team members at the Anchorage Field Office drafted at the beginning of our process. The Anchorage Field Office vision for the Bering Sea Western Interior Planning Area is to sustain the diverse and intact ecosystems that support traditional subsistence lifestyles while recognizing the importance of BLM lands to rural economies. Next slide. The BSWI RMP is located in the western interior, Alaska, within the heavy black line that you see on the map. The gold-colored lands, again, are the BLM-managed lands where RMP decisions will apply. The light blue color is also BLM-managed land, but this is land that has been selected by the state. The brown is Native Corporation-owned lands, blue, State of Alaska, and green, Fish and Wildlife Service on this map. The planning area includes many communities located close to BLM land along the middle and upper Kuskokwim and the lower Yukon. There are 69 federally recognized tribes, and we continue to provide updates and notifications to all these tribes. The tribes located close to BLM land tend to engage a bit more. We have three cooperating agencies on this plan, one of which is the State of Alaska, the Fish and Wildlife Service, and the Native Village of Tsleil-Waututh. These cooperators have attended many of our meetings, and they were present while we drafted our preliminary alternatives in 2014 and 15. They will also be present as we begin to refine a full range of alternatives for our draft RMP. Next slide. Slide 17. Once again, the BLM can receive public comment at any time during the planning process. On this graphic, I've numbered the stages in red, where you can see our official comment periods that we offered to encourage comment by a deadline so that we could analyze it and develop a report to organize the issues and concerns raised by stakeholders. Steps number 2 and 3 are not required, but we followed the lead of other offices who held a similar area of critical environmental concern focused comment period. We had two reasons for including step number 2. First, because we did not receive enough helpful input during the scoping period. Second, to ideally prevent getting input very late in the process, as other efforts have experienced and had significant delays. Step number 3 is what I spoke to earlier. The new planning, proposed planning and land use planning regulation changes that we refer to as Planning 2.0 calls for a new preliminary alternatives outreach public involvement phase prior to working on the draft resource management plan. In order to increase our ability to catch mistakes and make clarifications before writing the draft and decrease the likelihood of a supplement. To keep these phases distinctly separate, I've used the following terminology. Preliminary alternatives development is the term that I used for the in-house RMP team's first attempt to draft preliminary alternatives, which we began in 2014 and 15. The preliminary alternative concepts is the term that we use when referencing our conceptual ideas for alternatives at this stage that you see in the graph there. Alternatives refinement will be the second in-house RMP team effort to revise those preliminary alternatives with the benefit of stakeholder input from last spring's outreach period. This is what we will actually begin next month in developing our full range of alternatives for the draft RMP. Before we depart from this slide, I want to call your attention to the online open houses, which you'll see in black under public participation on the right-hand side of the slide. We hold those simultaneously on our RMP websites, where we offer the same maps, presentations, and materials as we do at our community meetings. Next slide. Slide number 18. Here's a brief overview of our public or stakeholder involvement steps. In scoping, we began it in 2013 and extended it to 2014 due to the government shutdown. We held 10 community meetings, offered about 12 presentations to groups who requested it, and released the scoping comment summary report in May of 2014. The areas of critical environmental concern comment and nomination period was held was a 120-day outreach and comment period, and we released the ACEC report on relevance and importance criteria in April of 2015. The preliminary alternatives outreach, we developed the alternative concepts that I spoke to based on the issues that were identified during our scoping process, and then we held a public outreach period last February through June 2015. We had 14 community meetings, government-to-government meetings, and offered about 3 presentations. In addition to requesting input on the preliminary alternative concepts, the BLM asked stakeholders for input on the next steps for each of the 5 reports listed on the slide. Those next steps are to determine visual resource management classes across BLM lands, determine lands to propose for protection of wilderness characteristics, to determine riparian conservation areas and restoration watersheds, to determine suitable river segments, to determine whether special management is required to protect relevant and important ACEC resource values. Our preliminary alternatives comment summary report was released in August of 2015, and it nicely summarizes and sorts public comment into 33 issues and presents the issues organized by community. For example, you can refer to a comment made by specific communities where we held meetings and understand the concerns among the Kuskokwim communities versus the Yukon River communities and so on. In addition, the report also organizes public comment by issue. So if there's a particular issue, such as trapping, you can look to see what 4 different communities shared about trapping on BLM lands near their community. Next slide. This slide nicely demonstrates the amount of comments we receive by visiting communities such as the one in the photo in Aniak. When we hold community meetings, I've found what works best is to summarize what issues and concerns are raised during the meeting, and I like to organize these by resource topics, fisheries, forestry, wildlife, and so on. We send those summaries back to communities for review, and eventually I post them to our website as community comment summaries. These community comment summaries become very helpful references for us as we continue our dialogue with communities and would likely be great references for you to understand the views of your constituents as well. I'd like to begin community meetings by reviewing the summary of what they shared with us the last time we visited, and that's proven a helpful way to begin discussions, in addition to time spent around maps in the community. The other category that you see on this slide in the graph refers to comments received outside of community meetings, those submitted via email, comment letters, phone calls, etc. As you will see on the next slide, we received 32 submissions, and each submission consisted of numerous individual comments, which is why this bar extends beyond 100. And on the next slide, here are the additional submissions received from the state, tribes, regional corporations, industry organizations, interest groups, and individuals. Next slide. The majority of our comments come from public meetings. Emails and letters come in second. All comments together yielded what was considered to be 893 total substantive comments for our preliminary alternatives outreach period last spring. Next slide. We're on slide number 22 now. Of the 33 total issue categories, these were the categories that received the most frequent comments in descending order of the number of comments received. Next, I'll cover some of the specific topics that we were asked to address today. Next slide. BLM uses special recreation permits to authorize and manage activities of state-approved commercial hunting guide operators on BLM-managed public land. We have 13 big game hunting permit holders in the Bering Sea Western Interior Planning Area, and these guides had 120 visits in 2013. You can see the definition of visit on the bottom of the slide. Currently, there is no maximum number of permits for hunting guides who operate on BLM-managed lands within guide use areas. Our recreation staff who manages these permits have received guide-on-guide conflict complaints for a number of years. These complaints tend to be in certain hotspot areas. In partnering with hunting guide outfitters, the BLM cares about the public land user's experience, impacts to subsistence, the condition of wildlife habitat, the quality of recreation opportunities available, and perceived conflict with other users. The BLM's land use planning process is the time for us to make allocation decisions, or what we attempted to do in this case, propose a maximum number of commercial hunting special recreation permits on BLM-managed public lands per guide use area. Next slide. Slide number 24. The alternative concepts that we shared in 2015 that related to BLM-authorized commercial hunting opportunities on public land included these two goals and objectives: to address both public input received during our scoping period from 2013 to 2014 regarding guide conflicts. Addressing the public input we received during scoping and some internal BLM input regarding the guide conflicts. We proposed a maximum number of hunting permits by guide use area. The permit numbers considered the 10-year average number of permits, and the proposed permit numbers by guide use area are higher than the existing number of permits within each guide use area. In order to address the stakeholder input from scoping, we proposed to not issue commercial hunting SRPs on BLM lands within a 25-mile radius of communities. Excuse me. Next slide. Slide 25. Another alternative concept we developed addressed different ways to handle transporters. Our definition of a transporter is someone who moves people and gear onto BLM-managed land via plane, boat, pack animal, etc. Currently, the only transporters under permit are those who are also state licensed guides that provide guiding services. What you see on this slide, you'll see alternative 1, alternative 2, and alternative 3. When we went through our preliminary alternative concept development with the RMP team, we didn't come up with our traditional full range of alternatives that you would see in the eventual draft resource management plans that we come out with. And so what I wanted to do was try to structure the document that we went out to stakeholders and communities with in a way that would be easy for them to provide us helpful feedback. And so if you could imagine, basically I had 3 columns, where under one column I had alternative 1 and some example management decisions we could make under alternative 1. Under column 3, I had example decisions under column 3 that differed from alternative 1. Column 2 was left blank. The way I tried to present this to communities, and this was our first time doing this, and it was sort of presenting conceptual ideas, was tell us what you like about alternative 1, if anything. Tell us what you like about alternative 3, if anything. If you like certain parts of each, plug them into alternative 2 and make alternative 2 what you're telling us you like. If you don't like anything we propose, tell us what you like and imagine that that's your alternative 2. So that was sort of my conceptual way of proposing to the community. Give us your alternative 2. Give us what you like, or tell us whether you like 1 or 3. So that's how these are structured. Okay, next slide. I guess we've gone over this slide. Yeah, next slide. So slide number 26. This is alternative 1 for the proposed number of SRPs per guide use area. So within 1 year of approving the plan, our concept here was to establish the following allocation limits for big game guide operators operating within each guide use area of the Bering Sea Western Interior Planning Area. So what you see there, 18-02, that's a guide use area number, and then in parentheses, the number 1 would be 1 commercial hunting guide SRP permit for that guide use area, and so on. That's what that list of numbers refers to. The first bullet basically describes that all those numbers add up to a maximum of 33 guide outfitters within the whole planning area. And those guide outfitters, again, are allocated by guide use area, or GUA. Guide outfitters may not operate in more than 2 GUAs on BLM land within the planning area. No SRPs would be authorized within a 25-mile radius of an established community on BLM, wherever there were BLM lands present in that 25-mile radius. And that BLM would continue to evaluate guide outfitters and transporter activities on a case-by-case basis as we do now. For new SRP holders, permits would be issued for 1 year and may be extended for up to 10 years total with annual validation requirements. Next slide. Of course, alternative two here was tell us if you liked anything from alternative one or what you would propose differently. And the difference here with alternative three is that SRPs for guide outfitters may be authorized near established communities, so that buffer zone idea went away in this proposed conceptual alternative. A maximum of 40 guide outfitters would occur within the planning area, and then each guide outfitter could operate in up to three guide use areas. Next slide. This is a most recent update that I have for you, also pertaining to your request for our presentation today. In December of 2015, the BLM presented some agency updates at the Big Game Commercial Services Board, the Alaska Professional Hunters Association, both of their annual meetings. These presentations resulted in multiple inquiries and questions that we received. We had some great dialogue with some folks on the questions we had. And what we decided to do was a targeted outreach to APHA and all the hunting permittees within the BSWE planning area, but because I could tell with my phone was ringing after the presentations that we really needed to provide some more information. So we have 18 hunting permittees that we targeted an outreach to in December, where we provided more information, we requested their comments, and then we also participated on a conference call with some of the outfitter guides as well as APHA. The public comment we've received to date, just in regard to this particular targeted outreach, is four comments that we received recently. And those will be considered as we develop, again, our full range of alternatives as we go into drafting our resource management plan. Next slide. So these are the websites where you can find all the information, reports, maps, and presentations that I spoke to. As well as contact information. And if you're interested and there's internet access and we have time at some point, I'd be happy to take you to one of the websites and just demonstrate how you can go and access those reports and maps. That's all I have.
Very good. Thank you, Ms. Berenger. Committee questions. Yes, Senator Coghill.
First of all, really appreciate you coming before us. What we're trying to do is figure out how can we work better, particularly game management is one of the big questions that we'll be working on. So, but there are a couple questions that maybe you could help me give a context to. I think especially with the guides and transporters and everything, we've been trying to figure out how to work this whole thing. But you have talked about high use periods. Those are specific hunting seasons, I take it, or help me, when you're talking about high use, is it people usage, is it commercial uses, things like that that might help us, for example, if it's hunting mostly that you were talking about, and it was way early in your presentation, I think it was on your resource management plan. Talking about high-use management. Just give me a context to that.
Yeah, that was in reference to Eastern Interior RMP. And again, Eastern Interior RMP has some pretty popular recreation areas. The White Mountains National Recreation Area, Beaver Creek, Wild and Scenic River, the Steese National Conservation Area, Birch Creek, Wild and Scenic River, the 40-mile Wild and Scenic River. So you could imagine there are certain time frames in the year when use is really high in those areas. I imagine what their goal is to limit the amount of conflict that occurs in those areas and provide a quality recreation experience by, they're looking beyond, it's not just hunting and guide special recreation permits, it's those people that are, running river trips and that sort of thing as well. So they're trying to get a handle on that. Does that help?
Yeah, it's cross-board usage, and that is
That's
true.
Right.
We have everything from kayakers to, photographers and hunters all trying to crowd into an area. Once I kind of figured that's what you're talking about. I wanted to make sure that.
Follow up, Senator Cantrell?
If I could just ask one broad, big question. Resource management planning is a cycle that you go through. Could you give us a context of that cycle? I mean, there's a planning time frame for these? You're talking about we're doing the Eastern, the Central, and the Bering at this point. Is that on a cycle, or is this something that you do that is a once-in-a-lifetime deal?
We wish.
Generally, it's a 20-year cycle. The idea is that these RMPs are supposed to last 20 years.
I just wanted to get a context to that. Thank you.
Yeah. So a question on page 26, it talks about the 25-mile radius around an established community. That seems like a pretty large radius. Is that truly what you're going to be implementing, or still under discussion?
Definitely under discussion. It was a conceptual idea. I like to go back to that terminology. It was something that our recreation staff came up with to address the issues that we heard during scoping from some of the communities along the Kuskokwim and the Lower Yukon in regard to there being conflicts between subsistence users and recreational hunters or guided hunters.
Okay, thank you. Further questions? Senator Costello.
Thank you for your presentation, and obviously there's been a lot of work that you've done so far. My question has to do with the role of the state of Alaska, and you had mentioned some terms including formal cooperator, that certain tribes are formal cooperators, and then you had used the term stakeholder. And my question has to do with, in terms of the state, what are we? Are we a formal cooperator? Are we a stakeholder, a partner? And how involved or how will you be using the state's expertise when you develop your plans?
Yeah, great question. The state is a formal cooperator for Bering Sea Western Interior, Central Yukon, and Eastern Interior. And what that means is the state has cooperating agency status. And many times the state is engaged in our internal discussions and internal meetings. So the state has a point of contact. I'm going to forget the name of the office. The OPUMP office is where she sits.
Mm-hmm. Project management.
That's right. Normally it's Samantha Carroll, who's out on sick leave, and Sue Maggie is who we work with right now. Oftentimes when Samantha can't make some of the meetings that we hold at my office, at Anchorage Field Office, she sends someone from DNR in her place that works at ADF&G, and he's great to have at our meetings. He has a lot of, he shares a lot of his knowledge with wildlife and fisheries, so it's awesome to have him there. So the state is very engaged internally with a lot of our meetings, and Samantha, you know, reminds us frequently when we're talking about things, well, you know what the state's view on that is going to be, and that sort of thing. So that's how they've been engaged in the way that I'm familiar with Bering Sea Western Interior, and I believe it's pretty similar with Central Yukon. I'm not as familiar with Eastern Interior.
No, I think it's similar.
And that was Director Cribley. Yes, Senator Costello, follow up.
One of the phrases you used was perhaps a protection of wilderness characteristics. And these plans are done every 20 years, and then the land is managed based off of the plan. Have there been new terms or new vocabulary or characteristics that we have that we're using now that we didn't use 20 years ago when the plan that we have now in place was created? And if so, could you describe some of those new terms that are being used?
Yes, the one that you brought up, lands with wilderness characteristics, is a new direction that we are following in the land use planning process. The plans that are in place for the planning area that I help manage, the Bering Sea Western Interior, are actually management framework plans which preceded resource management plans. A portion of the BSWE planning area is actually under the 1986 Central Yukon RMP, but the BSWE RMP will replace both of those planning efforts as well. So the management framework plan for the Bering Sea Western Interior is called the Southwest Management Framework Plan. I think it was 1981. So there's a lot of terminology that just didn't exist then. The way we look at watersheds and even wildlife habitat, managing wildland fire, there's a lot of new policy and direction that we'll be looking at differently in this planning effort and updating.
Follow-up. Yes, Senator Costello.
Where does the BLM get its authority in how you manage and prepare management plans for state for federal land in Alaska?
Our current land use planning regulations and under FLTMA, the 1976 Forest Land Policy Management Act, U.S. Code Title 43, U.S. Code as well.
Thank you.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm looking at the map on page 16. Okay. This is the Bering Sea area, true? Let's see. Right. Yes, Bering Sea Western Interior. So it's the yellow patches in this section that are BLM land. True?
True, and there's
On page 16, and maybe you could turn to that slide on your PowerPoint just so the audience can see it. It is quite a patchwork. Some tiny fragments there. And we're talking about 25-mile radiuses under consideration. I'm thinking about hunter concession type provisions. This creates quite a bit of discord between the state, which doesn't have guide concession program, and BLM, which is possibly going to be implementing one. We would sure like to work more collaboratively on that, just so that there's more continuity of regulations and land management for hunting. How would you respond to that?
Well, I guess terminology, first of all, the state uses the term concession program, and when they use the guide concession program, there's a lot that goes into that term and how selection of guides is made for operating in guide use areas. You know, the length of time they may have previously operated somewhere, whether or not they're grandfathered in, any past violations they might have, what their record is like, that sort of thing. So there's this lengthy process for selection of guides for those guide use areas. And just to clarify, so the BLM uses the term allocation, and what it was that we proposed, two different things, was in a guide use area, a maximum number of permits per the guide use area. And again, that number is higher than the number of permits that exist in the guide use areas, as I understand it. We weren't proposing a process by which to choose one guide over another, just a maximum number of permits per guide use area. And where there are those hot spots in the future, I think what our recreation staff had in mind is that those areas would get more attention, similar to what's going on with the Squirrel River area right now, where a process would actually be developed for how to choose amongst multiple guides that want to operate in the same area. So that's just, I just want to differentiate between the maximum limit or maximum number of permits per guide use area. The separate issue there was the zone, the 25-mile zone. And what we had proposed was no authorization of commercial hunting SRPs within on BLM lands, if there are any BLM lands within the 25-mile radius around a community. And a lot of communities tend to be surrounded by Native Corporation-owned lands. And then there are some here where there is more BLM land. And again, that was a concept, a radius that was proposed. And what we were looking for in that more recent round of feedback was, is there another radius that might make sense that would help us to address the issues that we heard from some communities during scoping about the conflict between subsistence and recreational hunting? Is there a more reasonable radius, or is no radius better? And we did get feedback on that with those recent comments that we received. Does that help address your question?
It does somewhat. In terms of the concession areas or allocation areas, as BLM refers to them, if BLM were to implement that, it would be quite a confusing situation since the state doesn't have a guide concession program right now. And we would certainly like to have more continuity between BLM and state management. So it is something that we look forward to collaborating with you on. So it is a goal that the state has, hoping that you will collaborate with us and we can implement this kind of program together. Yes, Senator Stoltz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question about management philosophy. If there's a large state area that has a designation, say, multiple use, and there's a contiguous federal area, BLM, how do you approach that? Do you approach it as of trying to keep compatible uses together, or have a contiguous use area that has a radically different, and how much cooperation is between the state and the federal government, and how much does an existing use area and its management philosophy influence how you determine how it should be managed?
We're required to be well, the state has what they call area plans, which you might be familiar with in this planning area. Fish and Wildlife Service, as I mentioned, has their CCPs, and those are the two other plans that we are required to be consistent or check to the extent possible that we can, and understand how those organizations, what their management style is, basically on the other side of the land ownership line. And the fact that both the Fish and Wildlife Service and the state of Alaska are cooperators on this plan and attend the meetings when we're discussing our ideas for how to address the issues that have come up. Generally, I think we do a really good job of being consistent with our neighbors, and there are plenty of other opportunities along the way for reviews that occur. As a cooperating agency, the state of Alaska generally gets to review and this is something that Samantha would coordinate with all the departments. The state of Alaska gets to review a lot of our documents prior to them ever going public. And so a lot of times internally we can have those discussions.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Further questions? Yes, Representative Tallarico.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. You had discussed a utility corridor withdrawal within the Central Yukon Plan. I guess I don't want to put you on the spot, but does BLM look at that as a favorable action, or process-wise and calendar-wise, where are we at in that process, and is that something that BLM has taken an interest in?
This is Bud Cribbley, and I'll answer that question. Okay. That you're elevating the question quite a bit beyond what Gina gets involved with, but essentially we're neutral on that particular issue, and the state has requested that we lift that withdrawal to allow that selection to fall into place so that those lands can be conveyed to the state, and we're not able to lift that withdrawal without going through a land use planning process. So, and that's one of the principal drivers of the need for the Central Yukon RMP. Also, just because of the significant amount of attention and use that we get in the Dalton corridor, and so we don't have a position on that. And essentially, what we're going to do, or our intent is to allow the land use planning process to drive that. By providing the public opportunities to provide input into that to help inform the Bureau of Land Management and the Secretary the Bureau of Land Management and what recommendation we would make to her on whether to lift all or a portion of that withdrawal. So basically we're neutral on that. We don't have an opinion. There would be concerns that we would have in relation to that if the withdrawal would be lifted, and a lot of that has to do with the existing infrastructure that we've invested into in that area, like campgrounds and such, and what the disposition of that would be, which would be more of a direct interest to the Bureau as opposed to just the allocation of the lands themselves and the resources that are involved.
Follow-up, Representative?
Thank you.
Further questions? Yes, Senator Costello.
Thank you. You had mentioned that as a cooperator, the state has the ability to review the plans before they're made public. My question has to do with the nature of that. So is that a role where the state is looking at whether or not the plan is consistent with any feedback or comments that you've seen? Or does the state have the ability to say, you know, we don't agree with the direction that this plan is taking, and does that, is that the nature of the conversation?
I would say it's a little bit of all the above.
Thank you.
In terms of the feedback, I noticed that you on the graphs here, or the slides you have, particularly on page 19, you show the number of community comment counts. That was an interesting slide. But at the bottom it says number of substantive comments. So I wondered how you decided if a comment was substantive or not.
That's a great question, and a common one. So I have a few examples. A substantive comment is a comment that suggests, number one, it can suggest specific changes in a BLM inventory, report, or alternative concept. A substantive comment would clearly identify where an issue or an error is located, why someone believes that there is an error in something that the BLM has proposed or done, or it would offer alternative ideas about how to address issues or errors. Third, a substantive comment would be one that provides constructive solutions with documentation or resources or research to support the recommendations or the comment that's being brought forth. A substantive comment is not a vague statement or concern that lacks suggested changes or gives us any direction in which to act. It's not a vote for or against a proposed decision or alternative. The BLM must rely on supporting information, not the number of comments received. Numerous comments expressing the same concern or issue are considered to be just one comment. So an example of that are form letters. When an interest group will start a form letter and send the same comment over and over with multiple signatures, that's not necessarily a substantive comment. We don't take the 500 form letters and count it as 500 comments. It's generally one comment if they all say the same thing. Does that help?
Very interesting, yes. It okay. Helps a lot. Good, actually, good to know. I'm glad to hear you use some criteria. Senator Coghill, did you have a question?
Well, there's two things. I'd like to ask a little further on that. So in putting forth comments, those who are available to comment, I suppose, get that information that it should be substantive, it should be relevant, it should be topical.
Yeah, when I visit communities, I do go over that with folks, and you know, oftentimes I get phone calls and I start typing during a phone call, and you know, take comments that way as well. So the comments come in many forms. When I have the opportunity to explain, such as in the form of a community meeting, I try to describe to the people what's helpful to us. But as I expressed earlier on one of my slides, when I visit communities, what I always try to have one of BLM staff doing is taking some detailed notes. We don't capture verbatim what people are saying. We're not doing, you know, court reporter style notes, but I like to try to get capture what everyone's saying in the community, because you know, just the discussion style nature of a lot of the communities that you visit, you get your best feedback from them at that point in time, not from a comment letter they sit down and write later. And so the process that I've found most helpful is I'll take whatever somebody wrote, usually we'll go back to whatever regional community we're staying in that night and sit down and go through what we wrote on the flip charts and what we captured writing down, and then I try to organize that, like I said, by fisheries and wildlife and ATV access and that sort of thing, and I go back and type that up in Anchorage and I mail that back to the community and I say, please revise this, let us know if we've reflected your comments correctly, and I let them know that we're going to post it on the website. And so that's on our website. What I have are called community comment summaries. And we have community comment summaries from our scoping efforts in 2013 and 14, as well as this most recent preliminary alternative concepts effort. So in addition to the scoping summary comment report, where you have all the comments organized in an appendices for all the comments we received, I've also done summaries of community comment summaries for both scoping and preliminary alternatives as well.
And the reason I brought that up, Madam Chair, is because we've tried to stay up with your management planning and make some comments that that from the state perspective will be relevant to you. Some very vociferous ones, some very bland ones, I guess probably would be the way to say it. But I appreciate that, and I think that's important. The other thing is, first of all, I really appreciate you coming here. When it comes to the state and working with how you see things is great. When we look at what we want to do in Alaska, we look at our state law first, and then when we deal with you, we look through ANILCA, ANCSA, to our statehood compact, and you have to look through FLTMA, ANCSA, to what we're doing. And sometimes we miss each other, and sometimes we have to really wrangle over some very, very different opinions. There's no doubt about it. But so, did I characterize it correctly, that you have to look through your regulation, which start with FLTMA, I suppose, and then works through ANILCA?
Yeah, I like the way you presented that, actually. That's pretty accurate.
All right, thank you.
Further questions?
I'm sort of a little bit of an off.
Senator Machicki.
Just how do you attribute the huge quantity of comments from Anchorage that's not directly related to the community where the planning is taking place? Is it just a population adjustment, or is there some other sort of activism that you might attribute it to?
Population and attendance, number one. But if the way we hold meetings in some of the Native communities, it's more of a discussion style, and within those communities, I think you tend to have the elders who speak up first and maybe speak on behalf of some of the others, and you tend to have some meeting attendees in those communities who might not speak up and share quite as much, or they do when they're surrounding a map on a wall over there, but yet we're taking notes with this person over here, and we might not capture everything that we can at a community meeting. We do our best. I think it's a reflection, like you said, of attendance and of maybe the nature of the discussions that we have at the rural versus the urban meetings, and those who are present in Anchorage, pretty much all of them, not afraid to get up and give comment.
So
follow up, Senator Machicki.
So that's kind of where I'm going with that. Is there a sort of a cultural difference where perhaps the urban comments may carry the day because they're used to a more formal communication style? I mean, how do you adjust for the difference cultural communication that might be more subtle in the rural communities?
Well, so something that I did bring up earlier was when we receive comments, those substantive comments are, we don't take them as votes and, how many times was a comment about this mentioned versus how many times was that comment mentioned. What we do when we do comment analysis, or when anyone looks at all those comments, is they determine what was the issue that was raised and try to capture those issues. And so what I brought up with the 33 issues that were brought up in preliminary alternatives outreach, those were the 33 issues that were parsed out of everything that we heard, regardless of, in a community, there might have been a community that commented about mining activities on BLM land. And in Anchorage, we might have heard the same thing, but the number of times we heard it didn't necessarily influence, hasn't made any influence. It's still a unique issue that was raised, and we categorize that as an issue. I don't know if that helps you.
It does. Madam Chair, last night, it seems like particularly in the land use areas that we're describing, that the rural communities probably, just an assumption on my part, are more likely to intimately know the land. And I would think that more of the urban comments are philosophical versus sort of hands-on experience or cultural experience. So just, it's difficult. You have a tough job on adjusting to what these folks are saying from 400 miles away because they believe things should be a certain way versus a person whose hunting grounds are affected close to the village.
Madam Chair, this is Bud Cribley, and I guess that's one thing. I've been in working in Alaska for about 5.5 years now, and that's one thing that has become very evident and very important to the Bureau of Land Management. I mean, we're going through a process on the North Slope, working with the native communities up there, developing a regional mitigation strategy to implement the use of mitigation funds. And we hear those types of concerns from the standpoint of outside influence overwhelming what the voice of the local communities are. And we are very much aware of that and sensitive to it, and that's why we do such extensive outreach going to the specific villages and providing for that opportunity for them to have a voice and going to a great degree of care to listen to that and capture those and figuring out ways to pull that information out and make folks comfortable to be able to share that with us. And we try to make it very clear that the playing field is level from the standpoint that somebody in a village, you know, has the same voice as, say, a major special interest group or a company, for that matter, you know, some kind of a development company, that we try to listen and balance all of those comments in when we're looking at how we're going to manage those public lands. But I fully appreciate what you're saying and understand that, and it's brought to our attention continuously, particularly by the Alaska Natives from the villages and stuff, and we try to be transparent but also trying to provide as great an opportunity as possible. And these folks on our planning team spend a lot of time flying to these villages, and this is why our comment, I don't know if you noticed, but our comment periods are 120 days, and typically the BLM does not do that down in the western states. Usually they're more like 60 to 90 days, and the reason our comment periods are so much longer is we're trying to, number one, facilitate enough time so that we can crawl into those small planes and fly to all those villages and stuff, which is necessary, but also trying to schedule our meetings so they fit into where folks are actually in the villages and they're not out doing subsistence fishing or subsistence hunting. And so our planning processes are a lot longer trying to accommodate that, and we recognize that and try to accommodate it to the best degree that we can. It's not perfect, but I think we're doing everything we can to make sure that everybody has a voice and that they all understand that their voices are heard, and try to provide that feedback and let them see that what we're hearing from them, and giving them every opportunity to get their opinions voiced and seen as a part of our planning processes.
Follow up, Senator Machicki?
Okay. And then there's the thing about Alaskans that worry that federal folks arrive in Alaska with kind of an assumption, because they've likely been assigned to other areas that don't have the wide expanse of land and perhaps wilderness opportunities in South Carolina are somewhat more limited than wilderness opportunities in Alaska. And some of the federal employees have become sort of conditioned about the importance of those few remaining wilderness areas in the lower 48. And there's a little bit of a fear that they arrive here preconditioned, even though we've got millions of square miles of wilderness opportunities. How do you make that adjustment as a federal employee?
Anybody coming from the lower 48 with the Bureau of Land Management and have not ever worked in Alaska cannot hit the ground running. There's an education process that all of us have to go through, because Alaska is so much different in a lot of different ways than how BLM manages other public lands in the western states. And a lot of it has to do with the additional laws that we manage for under ANCSCA and ANILCA, which puts a different slant and a different perspective on how we manage those lands. And also, what's so much different here than it is in the western states is the fact that so much of our lands are undeveloped. And this is one, and as a matter of fact, we have a difficult time communicating with our Washington office and those specialists when they're reviewing our plans and trying to explain to them. And one of the big issues is lands with wilderness characteristics. And like you say, in the western states, that is a very sensitive issue from the standpoint of identifying those. It's a priority for this secretary and director to making sure that we are, through our planning process, are aware of those lands. And when we're making decisions on allocation of use of those lands, how that's going to occur in the future. And one of the things we have to remind everybody is that in the most cases, about 95% of our lands that BLM manages, and in some cases it's 99.9%, like in the National Petroleum Reserve, have our lands with wilderness characteristics. So we have to have a different view or perspective on that from the standpoint of how we look at resource allocations and allow the use of those lands. But conversely, we have opportunities in Alaska from the standpoint that the lands are still undisturbed in our allocation, and making sure that we don't, I don't want to overstate or use the wrong word here, but we don't make the same mistakes that they made down in the western states from the standpoint that they were not cognizant of the landscape, the critical and important resource values, and how we managed for those and allowed for uses and permitted uses to occur on those lands. So we have opportunities here where the slate is clean to look at that and manage for that for the future, so that not only can we allow for development and economic development, which is very important, we recognize it's critically important to Alaska and its future for allowing the development of resources, but also taking care of and providing for what is very important to all Alaskans, is resources that are those natural resources and wildlife species that everybody moves up here and wants to enjoy. And that can be done, and that's what we're striving for. So it's trying to be informed of what our opportunities are. The slate is clean, and we can paint the picture the way we want it so that we can have the best of both. And that's what we're striving for. Our objective is not to lock up lands. It's to how to best manage those lands and meet our objectives, all of our objectives. And Alaskans want both sides of it, and we can do that. We need development, but we want to have those natural resources out there so that we can enjoy those. So that you're very much correct, and it does take time for our people to be able to become accustomed and reoriented. But we do go through that. We don't bring new people in and just throw them in and tell them to start making decisions. There's a lot of people around to help them and bring them up to speed before they get into that type of a position or situation.
You know, Director Quibley, I appreciate your reference to the resources that should be developed. I'm looking actually at your next slide on there, which is the enumeration of the commenters. And I'm looking at the interest groups and, well, for the most part, actually looking at the list of people who have commented, they're Alaskans. Except the interest groups. I see the Center for Water Advocacy and the Pew Charitable Trusts. And, you know, these are groups that typically are not Alaskans and often have a very different view, wanting to make our state into a park. And yet it's balanced out with the industry groups that you have on this chart for this particular Bering Sea Western Interior. You know, you've got the Miners Association, a gold company, and the Resource Development Council. So I heard what you said about people having substantive comments, detail, this is what we see wrong on this page, blah, blah, blah. You give credence to that, credibility to that. So these commenters, do you give more credibility if the commenters are Alaskans, or do these outside interest groups carry the same weight in their comments?
Well, I would have to say that they carry the same weight, but it's also a matter of what the comment is and the perspective and how that fits into what our objectives are. Like you say, there are some groups, conservation groups that, you know, feel everything should be a park or should be in wilderness or something, and we understand that and respect their views. But their comments have to be put into context of what our legal mandates are, which are multiple use and sustained yield of the public lands. And so it has to be a balanced approach. And so that's how we look at those comments. We don't give more weight to one side or the other. We just meet, what we try to strive for is to make sure that the voices are heard, and that not just the big companies or the big interest groups in the big cities are not the only ones that we're listening to, as we're striving to get the folks on the ground who have a vested interest, and in many ways their whole lifestyle is dependent on what decisions we make out there. And it's not just a lifestyle, it's literally their lives. I mean, there's people, we have communities out there, or, you know, their basic economy is, and their livelihood is based on subsistence activities. And we have to be respectful, and they have to have a word or say in what we're doing, and we can't be making decisions that are contrary, or we need to make informed decisions on what their needs are also. So, and this is, well, we just had a workshop last week up on the, in Fairbanks on the regional mitigation strategy for the NPRA, and in that one, it was almost reverse, where the communities had the loud voice, and the conservation groups who were participating in that were not participating, just because of the strong voice that we were hearing from the community. So the dynamics were very interesting, based on what, you know, what we would perceive as how things have been in the past. So we balance it. We have to push it or balance it both ways sometimes. So it's interesting sometimes, the meetings we get into. But they're never boring, I'll guarantee you that.
Well, speaking of the NPRA and a positive, we thank you for the remediation of those legacy wells, which we actually refer to as the travesty wells, left behind leaking oil and gas. And so thanks for your work remediating those. Further questions for the director or the management planner? Well, seeing none.
One last comment.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Senator Coghill.
So part of what we work with is fire suppression as well. Mm-hmm. And for the work that is done there, every year we have to stand up a unified organization, and I know that you've played a significant role in that. Mm-hmm. As we move forward, hopefully, we don't have to burn the whole state down before we figure out better ways of doing it. But I appreciate the quick and rapid response. I think the state has depended upon you mightily, and it's been a good partnership. I just didn't want that to go without some comment. And the other thing is, on the guide concession area and some of the management of land use planning, I think we're, from this committee at least, going to encourage our state to participate in whatever level we can to figure out a better way of doing it. I think that's an interest on our committee, certainly, and we'll be talking to both our congressional delegation and our governor on ways that we can do that. With our downturn in the economy, we're struggling on how to do it. But I think as we move forward, I guess a nod from you, if you're willing to even entertain that as a way to move forward, it'd be a good indicator to me.
No, I fully agree, and I don't think we will be successful unless the state and the Bureau of Land Management works together on managing guide and outfitter and transporter use on state or BLM and state lands. I think all we're going to do is play a shell game, pushing folks from one land base to another base, particularly if BLM goes into a more restrictive use of its public lands, and that I don't think that benefits the public as a whole. We have to address issues, but we would like to do it in conjunction with and complementary with the state of Alaska and their management of use on those on both public and state lands.
Thank you. Yes, very good. Well, thank you very much, Director Quibley and Project Manager Berenger. That was a great presentation. Thank you for taking our questions. We appreciate you coming. So that concludes our meeting agenda for today. Our next meeting will be on Monday, March 21st. The committee is going to take up House Bill 100 again and the nomination of Israel Payton to the Board of Fisheries. So with that, we stand adjourned. The time is 4:54 p.m.